Good morning. Welcome to the roundtable and to our panel discussion this morning. Very nice to have you with us. It is 13 minutes past 9 o'clock. It's a Friday edition of the show, so we have a special skip in our step, as we always do, of course. And it's nice to have you with us. A reminder, you can join us and share your thoughts by simply writing panel@wamc.org, panel@wamc.org. Let me introduce the panel to you, and then we'll get started with a wide range of subjects for you to sink your teeth into. WAMC's Alan Chartok, good morning, sir. How are you?
Good morning. I'm speaking from an undisclosed location in New York. We went to the Afropop 30th anniversary gala last night, and it was some doing, I'll tell you right now. It was wonderful. And WAMC came in for notice from the platform, and it was a huge crowd. And when they said WAMC, we got a cheer. So
that's,
it was a
great,
nice thing.
Very, very nice. Well, that sounds like a lovely evening.
Was Tony Allen there?
He may have been, but I wouldn't know it if I fell over him.
He was the drummer for Fela Kuti.
Ooh.
Yeah, I think he was there.
He is one of the.
I think he was there.
He is one of the most enjoyable drummers to listen to, and I'm not a drummer.
Yeah. No, I think he was there.
So you were out past your bedtime.
I certainly was.
All right. Well, we're glad you're here. Thank you very much. Judith Eng joins us. She is the regional administrator, former regional administrator for the Environmental Protection Agency, and she's a regular panelist on this program. We couldn't be more thrilled. Good morning. How are you?
Good morning. And unlike Alan, I did a little work last night, got in my pajamas early in Rensselaer County, and went to bed.
Yeah, it's not a bad way.
Living the dream.
It is actually, it is what we all dream about, I think.
That's
just
right.
Going to bed early sounds really good. Joe Bonilla is here, communications consultant and a very good friend of this program. Welcome. Good morning. How are you?
Good morning. You know, similar to Judith, I went to sleep early because I'm now on day 5 of no coffee. So feeling the pain right
really?
Now.
Really? Why did you stop drinking?
You know, it was like, I can live without it for a little bit. I might just start it tomorrow. Who knows?
All right.
But Joe's question is great. Why did you stop as I sit here sipping my coffee?
Yeah, I'm doing the same thing. I feel bad now.
I wanted to see what the impact was. I wanted to see how much energy I would lose. And I realized that around 10, 11 o'clock at night, I'm feeling actually tired, where normally I still feel gung-ho and ready to go.
But wouldn't you normally? Yeah. I mean,
most normal people would feel, you know, would go to sleep around that time. Me, I'm like, I'll keep on going.
When would you have your last cup of coffee?
Well, I would start the cup of coffee at 6 a.m., get it done at noon, and then last me for the entire night. Yeah.
You amateur. One cup of coffee from 6 a.m. to noon.
It's okay, but the big cup of coffee. It's a huge cup of coffee.
Yeah, keeps you going. Well,
right.
Good luck, and I hope you can make it till 10:30.
A.m.
This morning.
That's all we need
you
for
me doze off.
Next hour and 15 minutes, Joe. That's all we need you for.
We'll wake you.
Aaron Vizzitti joins us. He's a professor at Siena College, economics professor, and we love having him here. He's already been doing math. When I walked in, he and Judith were going at it with numbers and throwing back different things. I heard at one point Aaron said, I could probably have an Excel spreadsheet to you in a little bit. I'm like, wow, there's some stuff going on here during the breaks.
That's because I'm on my third cup of coffee this morning.
Thanks.
makes sense.
And we read in the paper this morning that it's the highest employment rate in the United States. Aaron, I take it that's what you're spreadsheeting on.
You're close.
So let's start there. Great way to start. Great segue. So and as soon as I can actually make my computer work, the unemployment rate fell, and it's 3.9% as the U.S. economy adds 164,000 jobs. This is the report for the month of April. It's the lowest point since 2000, according to federal economists. Aaron, what do we make of these numbers? What's the good news? What's the bad news? What should we know?
So it is unambiguously good news that the unemployment rate has fallen to 3.9%. The last time that happened was in the late 1990s, and the labor market has a lot of momentum, and it's been that momentum has been going on since 2010, 2011. And I'm sure Trump will take credit for this because of his policies.
Which Uri has this morning?
I did not check Twitter this morning, but I'm sure he did. Anyway, so that's really good news. Employers added 164,000 jobs. So that's the good news. And normally when unemployment falls below 4%, you start to see accelerating wage growth. So the bad news with this report is that we're not seeing the wage growth that normally accompanies low unemployment. So year-over-year wage growth was 2.6%. When unemployment drops below 4%, you're normally seeing 3.5% wage growth. One explanation for why wage growth has been so slow is that employers are able to just recruit workers who gave up looking for work during the recession and the exceptionally slow recovery. So it's a good sign that those workers who are called discouraged workers are starting to come back into the labor force and get jobs. But the bad news is they're not getting hired at high wages that are going to produce wage growth for the rest of the working population. So more bad news is that the labor force participation rate and the employment population ratio are unchanged. Workers who want to work full-time but can only find part-time work is unchanged. So all of these things are serving to keep wage growth down despite the fact that unemployment is at a 20-year low.
Does the president deserve some credit here? After all, he ran on this platform. He said he was going to provide more full employment. He's going to get some credit, isn't he?
He inherited a remarkably low unemployment rate, and it has stayed there. But to your point about does he deserve credit, certainly not for the unemployment numbers. But his tariff policy and his corporate tax cut are starting to show some signs of not working out the way he promised. A couple days ago, it was reported that factory investment slowed, primarily because they're uncertain about the price of steel and aluminum given the tariffs. You saw slower growth in investment during the latest GDP report. The one thing you saw a huge uptick in is stock buybacks from big companies, which serve to raise share prices and enrich shareholders, which was the point of the tax cut all along. I know his public statements were, well, this is going to lead to, you know, businesses having more profits, and that's going to lead to investment, and that's going to increase the demand for labor, and wages are going to go up. We're not seeing that. We're seeing slowing investment and increased stock buybacks, which, like I said, enrich the, you know, top 10% of the income distribution who own 90% of the stocks.
Well, we are so lucky to have you, as always, and I save my questions over the time till you come back. But the stock buyback, could you explain to our audience and to me what stock buyback really signifies?
Sure. So when companies have excess profits, usually they use that to invest and create new factories, new machines, new products. They can use that to replace old ones, or they can essentially buy back shares from shareholders. So what they're doing is reducing the supply of shares on the market, which mechanically will raise the price of the existing shares. So Apple announced a huge stock buyback in that Apple has used a lot of their profits to essentially take shares off the market. And what that does is it raises the price of the stock for existing shareholders and can increase dividend payments to those shareholders. So what they're doing is essentially reducing the supply of stocks in the market, which raises the price of those stocks.
Joe, would I be allowed to ask one more sort of unrelated question?
Yes, please.
You sound very excited about that.
No, I am. I'm just sipping my coffee. I apologize.
Okay, yeah. So, sorry, Aaron.
Envy.
We're just taunting Joe at this point.
So Volkswagen, it was announced this morning, nine top guys are under criminal indictment. They've had to pay the United States government alone, how much? $4 billion, $40 billion? I don't remember how much, but a lot of money.
Yeah.
What does that do to a company like Volkswagen? You're talking about stock buybacks for Apple. What happens to Volkswagen as they get caught literally
cheating on air pollution?
With their pants down, yeah.
It's a slap on the wrist. It's a big fine. Volkswagen is a absolutely massive multinational corporation. It was just like the Wells Fargo fine in that these businesses are always accused of wrongdoings, illegal activity, and the fines are not insignificant, but given how profitable these companies are, given the political clout they have, this is going to have a very minor effect. I mean, it might clean up their corporate practices so they don't lie about emissions testing, which is
especially
a positive sign because executives...
Especially if their leaders go to jail.
Yeah, exactly. Right, I was going to say, I think that's the bigger story, is that executives are being held accountable, and that has the possibility of changing corporate culture. But in terms of the overall financial performance of firms like Volkswagen and Wells Fargo, who is creating phantom accounts for customers who never signed up for them, this is just a slap on the wrist financially.
Yeah, that's interesting. This was a huge issue when I was at EPA. Volkswagen installed what's called defeat devices to trick the air testing on their diesel vehicles. And it was a major source of air pollution and a very... extensive EPA investigation, and then learned that other companies were doing the same thing. So, interesting to hear that it is just a financial slap on the wrist, but it certainly improves air quality.
Sure.
And when corporate executives go to jail, I think that can change the culture. But that doesn't seem to be working in West Virginia, where the coal guy, Lloyd Blanken.
Don
Blanken.
You're thinking of the CEO of Goldman Sachs.
No. Who's the coal guy who's running?
It's Don.
For Senate. Nah. Come on, Joe.
I'm looking.
He ran a coal company where 29 coal miners were killed in West Virginia.
Right.
And
Is he running in West Virginia?
Running in West Virginia. Yeah. He wants to knock
Blankenship.
Off. Blankenship. Blankenship.
There we go.
I had half of it. Thank you. Dreadful.
Very nice, non-Java boy.
Well, the coal. You could just continue with the coal guy. We got it.
Yeah. So the coal guy is attacking Mitch McConnell in incredibly racist ways, because Mitch McConnell's wife is of Chinese heritage. But more than that, was responsible for 29 deaths. He served jail time. He lives in Las Vegas. He's running for U.S. Senate. He wants to take on Joe Manchin. And I think this is part of the political climate that Donald Trump has created, that someone like him is not laughed out of the room, even though he did jail time for killing 29 people.
But if you were the Democrats, Judith...
We'd love to run against him.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. Exactly.
And he was very successful with questionable legal tactics about busting unions and just weakening workers' bargaining power.
Yeah.
And
but it's astonishing that he is a candidate for U.S. Senate.
But it's also, with West Virginia, I mean, Manchin's very vulnerable at this point. So, if it was a different state, this would be a candidate that the Democrats would want to run against. But I don't know given the challenges that Joe Manchin has, being really the only statewide elected official of the Democratic Party in West Virginia, it's tough.
Right, but, Robert Byrd was from West Virginia. It was not always like that.
Right.
It was
a different time.
But we've got Roy Moore, who did not succeed in Alabama.
Hope springs eternal, right?
Yeah, people keep pointing to Roy Moore, but, I think that there's no question a blue tide is coming in my mind. But Roy Moore was not a good example of a good candidate who had a chance of, he was just off the wall.
Yeah, he's a special case.
I'm reading these. I'm reading a letter. We don't usually do this. I'm reading out of turn. I usually wait till Sarah gives them to me, but I just saw this.
Joe, you're throwing a
I know. I just saw this one because it's just about what we were talking about. But Jonathan writes, isn't it true that these corporate fines of VW and Wells Fargo and others are allowed to be deducted from taxes?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yep.
Yep.
Well, which is a profound problem, and the tax law has to change.
Of course, you got to be paying taxes in the first place.
Right.
Well, this is how a lot of companies have effectively reduced their tax liability, their effective tax liability, to single digits.
Sure.
There's the sticker tax rate, which is what's on the books, but when you factor in loopholes, exemptions, deductions, that most of the largest corporations
perceived losses, yeah,
right,
yeah.
That accelerated depreciation, that a large majority of some of the U.S. and world's biggest companies pay taxes that are in the single digits
or none at all.
Zero. Yeah,
I
right.
I don't know
zero.
If it is still the case, but in recent memory, GE paid no taxes, no federal taxes.
No federal taxes, right?
So federal. Yeah. Fair share.
And I don't know if you guys all heard the Amazon story this morning on NPR, but it was quite clear that the in one place, Washington, Virginia, and Maryland, the combined governments were putting up billions of dollars in tax cuts to get Amazon.
Yeah. Well, look at Foxconn in Wisconsin, one of Trump's early perceived victories. And then there are ripple effects. Just a few days ago, I know everything comes back to the environment with me, but just a few days ago, EPA announced parts of the country that were or weren't meeting Clean Air Act requirements, meaning are we breathing healthy air? And it seems like Scott Pruitt's EPA fudged the numbers and allowed that part of Wisconsin to be in compliance with the Clean Air Act when, in fact, the numbers indicate otherwise.
So, Judith, what is it with these guys that they think, you know, this is the United States government, that they can get away with that stuff without getting attention to it?
And just a quick note that we've got to break in about a minute, but when we come back, we have a lot of Scott Pruitt stuff to talk about.
I'll bet.
Yeah. So, but to answer Alan's question, Judith?
I think they assume, first, that people won't find out, and then, secondly, it only gets reversed if someone sues them over this. And thankfully, Natural Resources Defense Council has already said they will sue on that. But there's just so much wrong going on at the EPA. We can't expect state attorneys general and environmental groups to sue on everything, although they're running as fast as they can.
All right, let's take a break. When we come back, we will continue our conversation. We have a lot to talk about, many topics to discuss. We'll, of course, talk about Scott Pruitt. We'll talk about Rudy Giuliani, those revelations, how that the second day of that story took on a life of its own. And, yes, we will turn about the we'll talk about the triumphant return of the House chaplain. Those and many more stories we will discuss. We welcome your thoughts. Panel at WAMC.org. Panel at WAMC.org. We'll be right back. That's somewhere you'll see her again and again. Art Garfunkel. Wow, good stuff this morning. Hearing from Art. The you know, part of Simon and Garfunkel is Garfunkel. Art Garfunkel will be playing at the Academy of Music in Northampton on Saturday. That's better known as tomorrow, Cinco de Mayo, the 5th of May. And if you can find out more information by going to aomtheater.com. I think that is correct. aomtheater.com. And you can sort of see the playlist at WMC.com. .org. All right. We have letters. The coal guy is presently running last in polls for the Republican primary race to run for West Virginia Senate. Perhaps Republicans are wishing, are wising up that they can't just run anybody. Do you think they're wising up?
I doubt he'll win, but the fact that he's running and has a platform is disturbing.
And he's also a loudmouth. I mean, he. He is very he is very dynamic. He is very good in front of people, from what I've seen. And I think at this point in U.S. politics, that's a
West Virginia
qualifier.
Exactly what I was going to say. You know, we've seen other examples of that win.
Mm-hmm. Well, I still think West Virginia is the anomaly here because you had a governor who switched parties to go back to the Republican Party. So again, it's not the same as it was 20 years ago when you had Jay Rockefeller and the Rockefellers running in there. So
To say nothing of Kennedy, didn't Kennedy win?
Kennedy won, right.
Zach checks in and says, any discussion of the lack of wage growth that doesn't include declining union density is incomplete. If we want wage growth, we need to encourage unionization to increase workers' bargaining power.
Absolutely. Yeah. The sustained effort from the 1980s on to weaken labor law and make it more difficult for workers to unionize has been a huge source of lower wage growth and rising inequality. Offshoring has, and now automation is starting to enter the picture. So, yeah, it's kind of the perfect storm for a period of exceptionally slow long-term wage growth.
Okay, so Aaron, here's my question, and I want just to identify myself for purposes. Yeah, for purposes of identification, I want to say I'm a longtime union man, and Al Pietschanker was a hero in my house growing up. But let me ask you, Do you think, Aaron, that any of this lies with the unions, the problems?
Yes. That, you know, it was primarily the manufacturing sector that made up the bulk of union members, and that sector has declined substantially since the 1970s, and it hasn't all been because of offshoring. That's been a part of it, but automation and increased productivity in manufacturing has made it so that that sector can make more output with less workers. So if you have less workers in a sector that was heavily unionized, manufacturing unionization rates are going down. And unions were, and I'm not bad-mouthing them, but they did not have a proactive strategy to deal with the rise of the service sector and figure out ways until very lately, like the jobs with justice, the janitors and the 15.
Minimum wage, $15.
Yeah, that this is great to see, but it's probably about 15 or 20 years too late. And I am a union supporter saying that.
So if you take a look at the Green Party candidate, who we just interviewed on the radio, and he was a Teamster all of his life.
Mm-hmm.
And he says, he was in the dissident part of the Teamsters. But he had to come up with the fact that the Teamsters were under federal supervision, that there was all kinds of hanky-panky going on, that the people who were running the union were not always of the first class, the first order. Some of that has to have permeated into the American consciousness, yes?
It does. That shifts the ideology. I don't know this for certain, but I'd have to imagine that part of the deunionization campaign beginning with Reagan has been demonizing a handful of leaders as being corrupt, and that changes public perception that all unions are corrupt.
Which is so interesting because in the Teamsters case, they delivered. The union delivered.
Right.
Big time. Huge amounts of money for union drivers and people who were in the union. And yet the price was pretty severe.
Yeah.
Well, that pension controversy was very significant.
It
and
was.
I can tell you my father was a Teamster and lost most of his pension because of that. And that affected thousands of hardworking working class people. And, there certainly was the optics of that and then the reality of so many Teamsters who were well paid but then literally got their pension stolen.
And what was that? Remind us all, Judith, that was organized crime infiltration?
I think that was another issue.
Okay.
I think this was the people managing the pension fund at the national union stealing money from the workers.
Yeah, I got to ask Ray Graff about, who's our sports guy who really knows, and Ian, which goalpost Hoffa is under?
We'll find out. We'll find out. All right, we got this letter, and then I'm going to move on to other subjects here. But Sarah says, Roy Moore lost because black women voted. Don't count on Don Blankenship losing, says Sarah in New Windsor.
Mm-hmm.
All right. Let's move on to other subjects. We go to, there we go. Let's talk about Rudy Giuliani for a few moments. There's a story about the new revelation suggests a president losing control of his narrative. This from the New York Times. As of last week, the American public had been told that President Trump's doctor had certified that he would be the healthiest individual ever elected, that the president was happy with his legal team and would not hire a new lawyer, that he did not know about the $130,000 payment to a former pornographic film actress who claimed to have an affair with him. As of this week, it turns out that the statement about his health was not actually from the doctor, but had been dictated by Mr. Trump himself, that the president has split with leaders of his legal team and hired the same new lawyer he had denied recruiting, and that Mr. Trump himself had financed the $130,000 payment intended to buy the silence of the actress known as Stormy Daniels. Even in the current political environment that some call the post-truth world, the past few days have offered a head-spinning series of revelations that conflicted with the version of the version of events Mr. Trump and his associates had previously provided. Whether called lies or misstatements, Mr. Trump's history of falsehoods has been extensively documented, but the string of factual distortions that came to light this week could come back to haunt him. That from the New York Times. Let us go over to the Washington Post and talking about the story about Rudolph Giuliani, which gives an inside story as to Giuliani's interview with Sean Hannity on Wednesday night. He may have had a strategy, but Rudolph Giuliani hatched it almost entirely in secret. The White House counsel had no idea, neither did the White House chief of staff, nor the White House press secretary, nor the White House lawyer overseeing its handling of the Russia investigation. They watched agog, yes, a word in the third paragraph of a Washington Post story on the front page, agog, as Giuliani, the president's recently installed personal attorney, freestyle on live television Wednesday night about the president's legal troubles and unveiled an explosive new fact that Trump reimbursed his longtime personal attorney, Michael Cohen, for the $130,000 paid to adult film actress Stormy Daniels to ensure her silence about an alleged sexual encounter with Trump. Giuliani's attempt to defuse a ticking time bomb exposed Trump's failure to divulge the full story about the Daniels hush money and highlighted contradictory public statements from him and from the White House spokesperson. Also, Sarah Huckabee Sanders had a difficult time defending all of this yesterday and seemed to be really having a, yes, having a very tough...
Terrible day.
Not having a great day as far as figuring this out, and I wanted to just find there was a great article. Well, I can't find it, but also talking about just about Giuliani. Mr. Giuliani, this is from the New York Times. Mr. Giuliani is loose-lipped, intemperate, confrontational, and supremely confident. They know he knows better than anyone else. Like Trump himself, the man once known as America's mayor for overseeing New York City after 9/11, has always faced down his critics with relish. And yet, suddenly on Wednesday night, Mr. Giuliani seemed reduced to America's grouchy dinner guest.
You know, Joe, to me, the idea here is that Giuliani is a politician. He's used to being the top dog. As I have said before, a lawyer's responsibility is to subsume himself to the client. And in fact, in this case, he can't do it. He just can't do it. He's not a team player, as evidenced by the disarray in the White House right now. You have that continual picture of the, pardon me, the president coming out on the plane and saying, I knew nothing about it. And now they're changing the narrative, and I predicted, by the way, that they would. They're changing the narrative to, well, he just gave him a regular retainer to do whatever he wanted, and that's the best they can do.
Well, Giuliani seems more about self-promotion of himself than being a good, careful lawyer for Trump. I don't think he's long for this world. I mean, for this world. I don't think he's long as Trump's personal attorney. And remember, he's the personal attorney. He's not the White House attorney. But I think that on a certain level, you know, Trump and Giuliani are two peas in a pod. But I don't think Trump is going to stand by while Giuliani continues to mess up like this. And also because he's getting so much attention. What I found really interesting is that he really screwed up on Hannity on Wednesday night, but then he was on Fox and Friends Thursday morning. The president didn't pull him back.
Well, that's true, and he seemed just to dig the hole deeper on Fox and Friends the next morning.
Yes,
the one thing that amazed me though in watching the Hannity interview again last night was that Hannity, who I don't like, but Hannity,
him you don't like?
I do. I have trouble stomaching him for like any length of time, but you know, like 2-3 minutes, something like that. Anyway, but there was a point where when Giuliani was doing his thing, even Hannity said, "Are you sure you want to say that?" I'm sorry, excuse me. Is that what you meant to say? Because this is what you're saying. And I think even, as I said, the word agog, I think even the Fox News didn't quite know what to make of it.
Well, there's another Fox News guy. I'm sorry, I forget his name. Starts with a C.
Neil Cavuto.
Thank you. He had an amazing commentary last night. Very critical of the president and the president's people. And I remember mentioning on this show last year, and eyes were rolling. I read it, and this is not an original idea. I listened carefully to a journalist on how will we finally get the country to wake up to the problems with Trump? And he said, when Fox News starts turning on Trump, that's when things will change. And I actually think, in a very modest way, Fox News is starting to point out the hypocrisy and the lies and all the problems. And maybe Giuliani will just, you know, accelerate the process.
But it goes to motive. See, I agree with you. It's when Fox turns, as the Statler brothers said, when they turn on the lights at Wrigley Field, which turned out to happen, turn on the lights at Wrigley Field. That may be too obscure for some of you, but the fact is that there's going to be a whole lot of people out there right now who have been backing Trump to the hilt.
Mm-hmm.
And when they see that the eventual outcome of this is so bad and so dire for Trump and the country, they're going to have to protect their fannies.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, this is, you know, we have a reality TV show host who's running the country like a reality TV show. Mm-hmm. And it's going to end in... It's not going to end the way Trump intended this TV show to end, and it's going to end with impeachment or just absolute disgrace or a nervous breakdown, I guess you could throw into the mix.
Or jail time.
Or all of the above.
All of the above. But, I mean, here's the thing. You have this image-conscious president, this reality show president, who is used to saying, well, you know, I built this great company. I built this whole reputation as being this deal maker. Then my company fell apart, and I built it back up, and now I can run the country. But at the end of the day, you know, you can only cover up so much. And when you have the story of him dictating this letter to his doctor, I mean, it's like, how much more P.T. Barnum 2.0 can you get?
And didn't we all suspect that when we heard the letter?
Oh, yeah.
It's like, no doctor writes
like that. No. Although then when you saw the guy, you're like, all
right.
Well,
maybe it might happen. Right.
Ronnie Jackson and Bornstein.
Yeah. You didn't believe his glowing health. You know,
well, just to make sense, no. Yeah. So, as there's this Times piece, though, that the we have to take a break. But this Times piece about the president losing control of his narrative, I find to be really interesting because there's a line in here saying, as a matter of politics, the latest contradictions may not matter much, at least not yet. The public, to some extent, has grown accustomed to the factual deviations or written them off as unimportant. Mr. Trump surpassed 3,000 false or misleading claims since taking office, according to a running tally by the Washington Post. That's an average of 6.5 per day. And there is a wonderful, if you get a chance and you haven't seen it yet, there is a wonderful interchange between Anderson Cooper and a panelist who is a Trump supporter. And Anderson Cooper said, well, do you believe, you have to at least admit that he doesn't tell the truth always. And he said, no, he's never told a lie. And Anderson Cooper just stops and says, I'm sorry, really? What? Anderson Cooper just didn't know what to make of it. Like, yeah. I cannot, you can still support him, but you have to at least admit this happens, right?
Yeah.
No.
But quickly back to Giuliani. I tweeted yesterday that I encouraged Fox to have Giuliani on every day.
Oh, yeah. Oh, no, that is, if you're looking for the reality show, that's it, right?
That's it.
All right, let's take a break. When we come back, we'll continue. We welcome your letters. Panel at WAMC.org. We'll be right back. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion this morning. Alan Chartok, Judith Eng, Joe Bonilla, and Aaron Pasitti. We welcome your letters. Panel at WAMC.org. Panel at WAMC.org. We have a few minutes before we go to the top of the hour news break with Ray Graff. And before we do that, I would like to start us at least... bring us into the subject of Scott Pruitt. We were talking about him, and there's some really interesting stories that have come out over the past, several days, really. The one here is about, why not buy a house?
Let's do it.
Since movie and don't pay for it yourself, for God's sake.
And do it through a LLC.
Yeah.
With lobbyists who are lobbying you.
Since moving to Washington, Scott Pruitt, the head of the EPA, has attracted the attention of federal investigators because of his unusual association with lobbyists, including his rental of a condominium last year owned by the wife of a lobbyist with business before the EPA. As a state senator in Oklahoma 15 years ago, Mr. Pruitt went even further. He bought a house in the state capitol with a registered lobbyist who was pushing for changes to the state's workers' compensation rules, changes that Mr. Pruitt championed in the legislature. This goes to the point that Judith has made on the show many, many, many times. You don't have to go very far into his record. Mm-hmm. Look at what he did in Oklahoma, right, and you can certainly see the similarities to what is happening on a federal level. Also, influential outsiders have played a key role in Scott Pruitt's foreign travel. EPA Administrator Scott Pruitt his itinerary for a February trip to Israel was remarkable by any standard for an EPA administrator. But one force behind his eclectic agenda, Sheldon Adelson, a major supporter of Israel, who arranged parts of the visit. And then that trip was canceled, right?
Mm-hmm.
And
yes.
then
because of Hurricane Harvey.
Days before his departure. But all of this comes to show that there are a lot of outside influences in this man's agenda. Is that fair to say?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think the way he does public service, I mean, there are a couple crucial issues here that we shouldn't lose sight of. You know, most importantly is he is gutting the EPA. He's already repealed 20 major important federal environmental regulations, and he is about 40 in the queue to deregulate this year. In his first year, he tried to cut the EPA budget by 31%, and thanks to the work of Congress and the public, that was blocked. And every day, he's doing damage at the agency, taking science out of decision-making. And this week, two of his top people resigned. His top Superfund staff person, who actually came to Hoosick Falls about a week and a half ago to hear about the toxic contamination problem there, Mr. Kelly, stepped down this week. And the new Superfund guy is a lawyer from Dow. So even if Pruitt goes away, which I
Dow
firmly...
Chemical, no,
Dow Chemical.
Not Dow Jones.
No,
yes.
Dow Chemical. Even if Pruitt goes away, you know, the horrible anti-environmental policies will stay. I don't think they'll get a replacement through the Senate to confirm a replacement. So they'll elevate this guy, Andy Wheeler, who was recently confirmed as the deputy at EPA. He, Andy Wheeler... has been recently a lobbyist for the coal industry and the nuclear industry. But hopefully he'll have the good sense not to be a walking ethics violation as Scott Pruitt is. I want to point out that Pruitt is facing 11 different federal investigations, both from his own inspector general at the EPA and in Congress. And the press is doing a phenomenal job this week. There were a new round of stories about his trip to Morocco. The Washington Post actually sent a reporter to Morocco to do some fact-checking. Apparently, Pruitt has made a list of countries he wants to visit and asked his staff to come up with a justification for him to travel there. And then my favorite Pruitt story came out yesterday in The Atlantic, where it was confirmed that EPA press staff were pitching reporters to do stories about wrongdoing by Interior Secretary Ryan Zinke to
yes.
take the attention away from Pruitt. And the Interior Department had to complain to the White House to get the EPA press people to back off on Zinke. And that's just a couple days.
And that was just, I'm sorry, Aaron, but it seemed like it was... well, you think I'm bad. Look at what
right.
this guy's doing.
Yeah, and Zinke is doing terrible things, but it is kind of amusing that you've got the EPA press office trying to get reporters to report on wrongdoing by Zinke just to take attention off of Pruitt. I don't think it worked. I think reporters are still on the Pruitt beat.
Well, and you can be on the Pruitt and the Zinke beat.
Yes.
Like, there's a lot of bad stuff going on.
I'd like to make a broader point about lobbyists and the role lobbyists play, because I think this is... a very important subset of a much larger problem. In 2017, federal lobbyists, just in D.C., so forget about state lobbyists, spent $867 million mm-hmm. on lobbying efforts.
Yeah.
There are 10,000 registered lobbyists in D.C. That works out to 18 lobbyists per congressman and spending of $1.6 million per congressman.
And they're making lots of campaign contributions.
Absolutely.
Yeah. No, I know. I mean, this is a systemic. I mean, this is the elite capture of politics, where it's run by a handful of wealthy interests who just buy people to buy politicians.
Oh, it's
an investment in politics.
It's public bribery. Right. And now they're Scott Pruitt's travel agents.
Yeah. Well, now you have basically most of these people in this administration are allergic to ethics. And then you have the Zinke and Pruitt. You know, they're a plague. You remember when Zinke had the whole deal with Puerto Rico with Whitefish. So again, it's not surprising. It's egregious. You know, I'm glad the media is keeping their attention to it, but again, it's par for the course.
But remember Tom Price, the former HHS secretary, got let go for like one tiny piece of what Pruitt and Zinke are doing. It seemed like such a simpler time 6 months ago.
Well, it was a simpler time.
Just the quainter time.
Less to try to figure out. All right, we're going to take a news break. When we come back, we have a lot more to talk about. We welcome your letters. We have some. We'll get more. Panel at WAMC.org. Panel at WAMC.org. We'll be right back. I love you, and that's all I know. Art Garfunkel playing us in and playing at the Academy of Music Theater in Northampton on Saturday, and sounding great
beautiful.
As always.
Really
always
beautiful.
Good stuff. It's our panel, our last round here. Alan Chartok, Judah Thank, Joe Bonilla, and Aaron Pasitti. I'm Joe Donahue, and we welcome you with your letters, panel at WAMC.org. I have letters in front of me. Let us go through those.
Last round at the bar.
That's right.
That's right.
Last call. Conservative. Conservative view of government is the subject line of Hans's email, which says hard right conservatives have such a negative view of government they can no longer conceive of any positive role it might play. Hence, those who break federal laws like EPA regulations are seen as heroes.
I totally disagree with that. Conservatives use government very effectively to redistribute wealth from working and middle and upper middle class families to the very wealthy. And they do that through things like patent law. They use it to weaken the labor movement. Conservatives use government very effectively,
and they sure,
but they do it to accomplish their own objectives.
And they sure drive up federal spending.
Big time, even though they say that they're against it. Yeah.
All right. Then James says, Harvard Environmental Law Online has an environmental regulations rollback tracker that is tracking the many issues involved in Pruitt's attempts to eliminate the EPA.
It's right on the EPA website. They're very proud of it. It's this handy chart I go to once or twice a month with what's already been rolled back and what's in the queue. And it's horrible. It's drinking water protections, clean air protections, pesticide protection for farm workers and for all of us who don't want pesticide residue on our food. I mean, what'll be very interesting to see is if academics can quantify the damage to health and the economy as these rules are rolled back. But I'll also add that a lot of them are being challenged in court thanks to the great work of our state attorneys general like Eric Schneiderman and Maura Healy and the Connecticut AG and environmental groups, but they can't cover everything.
Barbara writes, listening to the comments about unions and how they are needed, I agree that they serve a very necessary purpose. However, I do wish that someone would address the fact that every time the union wins a wage increase, more benefits and so on, the prices go up. Face it, the corporations are not going to swallow the income loss the raise creates. They are going to pass it on to customers. Thus, more cost of living increases, and the circle starts once again.
Tough darts. I mean, think about it. Yeah, it may be true, but on the other, and it may just be an excuse, of course, to raise the prices. But what really gets me with all of this is you can't both talk about how you need to have the wages raised in the United States and then not understand that there's going to be some consequences, Aaron.
Sure, absolutely. I mean, the alternative that everybody seems to miss is that corporations could accept lower profits and pay lower dividends to shareholders and forgo price increases.
Yeah,
they won't do it.
Yeah, I think Alan had it right when he said tough darts. I think we want people to have a living wage. We want people to have health insurance. We want people to have pensions so they don't live in poverty when they're senior citizens. I mean, unions bring us all of those things.
And let me, Judith, for a second, compliment you on what you just said and reinforce it. And that is what? You want people walking around in smog-filled cities where their kids die of asthma and they mm-hmm. die of asthma, mm-hmm. And you can't get through the soot, which we had in New York mm-hmm. City, which they have yes. in L.A.? Are you kidding?
We're rolling back. We're going back to those times when that iconic picture of the George Washington Bridge covered in smog, the Cuyahoga River in Ohio on fire. We are gradually rolling back to that time if Scott Pruitt has his way for 4 years.
Can I go back to the union thing for a second? There are many other countries in the world who have substantially higher unionization rates than we have in the United States, where workers get paid a living wage, they get annual raises that not only keep up but exceed the cost of living, and their inflation rates and cost of living and price increases are not that different from what we have in the United States.
But the challenge is obviously the union rate, and obviously folks who are not part of a union, who basically they're not able to pay for those same goods and services at the same time. So everybody's not rising at the same level at the
and
same
the Janus,
time.
And the Janus decision, right, is that the name is coming, which is going to decapitate unions even mm-hmm. more. Mm-hmm. So this is but what's interesting to me is if you're looking at the unionization or the power of unions in teachers in these mm-hmm. states, which are coming out with thousands of teachers going out and say, we don't give a damn, we are going to get a living wage. And guess what? They do.
Mm-hmm. In places like Oklahoma right. and sure. West Virginia.
We final letter for this round, and that's from Stephen, whose subject line is Trump in jail. That's what will not happen, says Stephen. White guys with lots of money do not do time.
Tell that to the highest, to the biggest thief in the history of American government who's sitting there in prison right now. Right?
Who?
You don't remember something called the Madoff
effect? Yeah, Bernie Madoff, yeah.
Oh, a financier, Bernie not Madoff, a yeah. politician. But yeah.
I do generally that.
White guy.
I generally, yes. There are very few affluent white guys in jail. I think with certainly Madoff as an exception. But I don't think we're going to see Trump in jail. I think we may very well see members of his administration in jail by the time Mueller
is
done.
Right.
That's true. And I'm going to predict. And with great respect to you, Judith, that we are going to see this guy in jail.
Trump.
We're going to see Trump in jail.
Great. I hope you're right.
His jumpsuit, it'll be perfect because his jumpsuit will match his skin and hair color.
Very nice. Very nice.
You like that?
Yeah, I like
nice.
That. Yeah, that's good. And probably made in China. Yeah, no.
Right.
Yeah. The Ivanka brand. My niece went out and she was we were going to this wedding this weekend and she was going out and buying a dress for the wedding, and she's young and said, can I, just a new job, and she said, so I gave her some money for the dress.
Aha! I knew where this was going.
All right. Well, no. This is the part of the story. So I said to her, did you find a dress? And she said yes, and I said, so I'll see it. I'll see it at the wedding. And she goes, yes, and I'm never going to tell you what it is. And I said, what? And she said, it's an Ivanka Trump dress. And I said, I'm sorry, you have to take that back.
Voting with your wallet.
That's right.
My apologies.
That's right.
But she didn't.
No, that worked out, actually. Yeah.
Yeah.
She blamed it on not fitting good, but
good. Excellent.
Anyway, let's go on to other stuff. I was horrified, I have to say.
Yeah.
So let's go to the story about... I love the story. I just want to make sure we have time for the story. So I love the story. So you will remember that for some inexplicable reason, the house chaplain, the Jesuit, was fired. Paul Ryan fired the house chaplain because of ultimately saying that he was concerned because he had basically were praying for people who would be affected by the tax cuts.
He's a Jesuit.
He's
what do
a
you
Jesuit.
Expect?
Yes.
And I love the Jesuit.
So it didn't go over well, and there were a lot of people who thought that it was petty and silly and mean spirited. So, but it seemed like it was all going to go away, and it was just going to happen. And Ryan is on his way out, and nothing was going to happen. This was what he said. Conroy delivered a prayer. Said, may their efforts these days guarantee that there are not winners and losers under new tax laws, but benefits balanced and shared by all.
Sounds like a Democratic message to me.
Well,
I think that's what it was all about. And mm-hmm. instead of thinking it through, it got worse and worse as some of the Ryan supporters were saying things. It's time for a Protestant to be the chaplain.
It's time for Father Conroy to go. Well, Father Conroy then decided, I'm going to fight this, and said, and other than the Pope, I don't know who his superior is, but he went into the house mm-hmm. and with the help of mm-hmm. Nancy Pelosi and said, hey, mm-hmm. this doesn't seem right. And well, darn if he didn't get his job back yesterday. In a statement from Ryan's office, he said, I disagree with Father Conroy's recollection of our conversation. I'm disappointed by the misunderstanding.
Yeah, the priest lied.
But yes, wish him the best as he continues to serve the house. Yeah, so...
He had no choice. I mean, he was up against the wall. No question about it. It had gotten to be so bad, such a laughingstock, and so inappropriate in terms of divisiveness about religions that that he had no choice. It was the right thing for him to do, which is to get the heck out of Dodge.
Well, so he was on a break. The Father Conroy was on a break for a week, and many in the GOP said, well, this will just go away. It's going to die down. Nothing's going to happen. And then when he came back, all of a sudden there was this, a lot of people were saying, okay, but now Jonathan Birx, who is Ryan's chief of staff, accusing him of an anti-Catholic bias, and there was a backlash, but it was bipartisan. It was a bipartisan mm-hmm. backlash. 140 Catholics in the House, mm-hmm. and almost all of them were very, very upset by the dismissal of Father yeah. Conroy.
Although I think this really has so little to do with Catholicism, yeah. and has so much to do with Paul Ryan and how he just, I mean, this is now how we will remember Ryan's speakership, I hope. Bad judgment by Paul Ryan. It's obvious why they tried to, let's treasure these words, fire a Catholic priest for speaking out in defense of the poor. And then Ryan's chief of staff made it worse by saying, oh, no, it's not what he said. We had problems with his pastoral care. But I think this whole episode, almost more than anything, illustrates how bad Washington has gotten. I mean, I just can't think of anything worse than this incident.
It doesn't surprise me, though, because you have this Catholic speaker having a fight with a Catholic priest, just like Paul Ryan is having a fight with fellow Republicans at the same time. So for some reason, folks who are in the same party or the same side or same religion, he can't get along with.
You know what? There are a lot of Catholics in the United States. There are far few Jewish people in the United States, 2% of the population, by the way. Nevertheless, somebody attacks your group, and there will be hell to pay.
I mean, I do agree with Judith, though. I think it has less to do with the Catholicism as a whole, but more to the idea that the guy who is saying, let's pray for those who are poor,
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Right. has lost his job, mm-hmm. and Pruitt,
mm-hmm. right,
who is doing whatever he can do,
gallivanting all over the world with lobbyists and
doesn't
first class.
Lose his job.
Yeah.
I mean, it does not make a whole lot of sense.
No, it does not.
Now you can argue all you want, and I think it's a valid argument of, you know, separation of church and state and house pastors and all of that. I get that,
mm-hmm.
but. The idea of saying, oh, let's say a prayer for those who may be less fortunate than us. Okay.
And I don't right. know Father Conroy, but from what I've read, it sounds like he is the sort of Jesuit that yeah. will also pray for the soul of Scott Pruitt, especially as Pruitt is headed to a federal penitentiary sometime in the future. But, I mean, the guy did not seem very partisan. He seemed like he was the chaplain for the house, and he provides spiritual and religious support. And God knows, we want some spiritual balance in the Congress.
Well, you know, I don't agree with you, Judith. Respectfully,
okay.
Honestly, there's no question in my mind that this is a political message. Now, politics, as I have said so many times, is the authoritative allocation of scarce resources. And we know where the Democrats are, and we know where the Republicans are. And it was decidedly a Democratic kind of thing to say. I happen to subscribe to those values. But I think that when they saw it, and they got a couple of people from the Freedom Caucus yelling at them for it, Ryan, he jumped precipitously.
I think we need a Franciscan.
Franciscan out of the
What's interesting
How about a rabbi?
He's the second Catholic priest since 2000, and actually ever to be the house chaplain. So, yeah.
I guess, but again, I go back to what he was saying of just to pray for those who are less fortunate. Yeah. And I guess, I mean, so is that
what's
point?
So
I think,
wrong
but
with
that's
that?
Your point that is that anything yeah. now when you're talking about people who have and those who have not, that suddenly becomes political.
That's right, Joe.
Yeah. Yeah, and that's a sad state of affairs, and it's reached the level of, you know, kneecapping a Jesuit priest because he was praying for the poor on the House of Representatives floor. I mean, how low can we go?
Yep.
All right, we are just about out of time. But
on that happy note,
yeah,
on
that happy the visual note, right there. Yeah, I don't know. Priest.
Yeah. You know, if you think of one job that would be safe, you would think it would be the Jesuit priest who's in the...
And also the White House, what was that position in the White House where it was totally nonpartisan, the person just kind of...
The secretary, like the social...
Not the social director, but they just kind of ran the White House to make sure the trains and buses ran on time. And that guy got knocked out.
Yeah.
Like he'd been in this position for decades.
I do want to get to this story before we wrap up. President Trump has ordered the Pentagon to prepare options for drawing down American troops in South Korea just weeks before he holds a landmark meeting with North Korea's leader, Kim Jong-un. That, according to several people briefed on the deliberations, reduced troop levels are not intended to be a bargaining chip in Mr. Trump's talks with Mr. Kim about his weapons program, these officials said. But they acknowledge that a peace treaty between the two Koreas could diminish the need for 28,500 soldiers currently stationed on the peninsula. Mr. Trump has been determined to withdraw troops from South Korea, arguing that the United States is not adequately compensated for the cost of maintaining them, that the troops are mainly protecting Japan, and that decades of American military presence has not prevented the North from becoming a nuclear threat.
I think Trump is right, and this is the same position that Jimmy Carter had.
Well, Kim is clear that in order to reach this decision, his card that he needs played is that the troops get out of there. So I think what's happening here is that Trump is preempting this discussion by saying, I was going to do it anyway.
Just as a side note, that the cost of those maintaining those upkeep of the soldiers in South Korea is $800 million a year, which represents just a little over 1% of all defense spending.
But we could do many other things with $800 million a year.
Right.
I don't have great confidence in President Trump's diplomatic skills. During the campaign, he also said that North Korea and South Korea should get their own nuclear weapons, so we don't have to pay for that. However, I do think it's not a bad time to start rolling back troop presence in South Korea. In fact, during the Iraq War, 10,000 troops were pulled out by Rumsfeld to fight that dreadful war in Iraq. And I'm curious, did they do any analysis to see what were the impact of reducing troop level by 10,000? I think this is, as Eisenhower said, the military-industrial complex. The Pentagon is against reducing troop presence there. I think it makes a lot of sense to pull back, you know, not immediately, but gradually.
But it's gut check diplomacy, though. I mean, it's at the same time, you know, will we actually have him follow through with this order? You know, we've seen time and time again, he'll talk, you know, this big game.
Like and on then, tariffs. Yeah.
Right, on tariffs, exactly. Right, so it remains to be seen whether or not he actually fulfills this promise that he makes.
Mm-hmm. The directive has rattled officials at the Pentagon and other agencies who worry that any reduction could weaken the American alliance with South Korea and raise fears of neighboring Japan at the very moment that the United States is embarking on a risky nuclear negotiation with the North.
That said, Joe, with the absolute understanding that it's the South Koreans that are leading the way in terms of this rapprochement. So how can you be arguing that we're going to pull the rug out from under the South Koreans when, in fact, the South Koreans are signaling that they're going in another direction?
I think it's more Japan. I think Japan wants the presence there, and they can now, you know, they pay for half of the troops. They spend $800 million a year, and Trump is saying, okay, we'll leave troops there, but Japan, you pay for almost all of it.
Yeah. I do want to mention that that the president is speaking right now as he's going to the Andrews.
And he's on his way to speak at the NRA meeting today.
That's right. And he was asked
20 acres of guns.
He was asked about Rudolph Giuliani, and he says that he is a great guy, but he's still learning. He just got his job this week. He'll get his facts straight. That is the quote.
That sounds like a threat.
Otherwise known as Goodbye Rudy.
Yeah, that well, yeah. Right? I mean, it's right.
Shall we start a pool?
He'll get his facts straight.
Who's
if he
gone
doesn't.
First, Rudy or Pruitt?
That sounds like a good Art Garfunkel song. Goodbye,
well, no, it
Rudy.
Yeah, like, well, it sounds like Rudy Kazooty. Rudy Kazooty and Little Nipper the pup.
He also said that he would love to speak with Robert Mueller, but his lawyers advise against it. Nobody wants to speak more than me. In fact, against my lawyers, because most lawyers, they never speak on anything. I would love to speak, but because we have done nothing wrong. There was no collusion with the Russians. There was nothing, no obstruction.
And on Stormy Daniels, the president is saying we haven't changed our story. But no, everyone knows that's not true. They've changed their story three or four times.
Well, it depends on who tells it, I guess.
Trump's missing the bigger point that if he talks to Mueller, even if there's no Russia link, he could still perjure himself.
Oh, absolutely.
Mm-hmm. I mean,
absolutely.
Yeah. He's never going to talk to Mueller. But I really hope Giuliani is on Fox News every day.
I might start watching Fox News if he becomes a regular.
And again, the president also, just because we were just talking about South Korea, but North Korea says that the trip is being scheduled. We now have a date and we have a location. We'll be announcing it soon.
Oh,
he did one of his stay tuned things, which we always love. Those are all really good Friday stuff there. Yeah. Okay. So we are done for the morning. My thanks to Alan Chartok. Alan, be well. Thank you very much. Judith, thank you.
Great to be
for
here.
Being here. Always good to have you, Joe. Nice to have you here.
As always.
Be well. Good luck with the coffee thing. And Aaron, we'll see you next week.
Yes.
Thank you very much. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.